Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Do you feel your IQ going up today? Maybe it's all the science in town. Today's the first day of the annual World Science Festival with panels and participatory events at locations around the city today through Sunday. You can stargaze with an astronaut, count fish in the Hudson, or listen to great stories and fascinating people talk about their life's work. We're joined by two of those people now. Brian Green, professor of math and physics at Columbia University and co-founder of the festival, and oceanographer Sylvia Earle. Listing all of her titles and honors could take up the rest of the time we have to talk to her, but she's a marine biologist, an explorer in residence for the National Geographic Society, who has spent over 7,000 hours undersea, a former chief scientist at NOAA. She's been designated a living legend, a hero for the planet, and even her deepness. Welcome back, Brian Green, and welcome to WNYC, Dr. Earle.
Thank you.
Brian, is there an overarching theme for this year's festival?
We almost never have themes. What we try to do is find the best stories of science in a given year and bring those out to the public. So, of course, one big story is the discovery of gravitational waves, something that we discussed here on the program not too long ago, and the discovery of general relativity. But we're also doing a whole lot of other things. Like, I'm doing a program tomorrow night, unusual one, where we're looking at how science interfaces with the things that really speak to the human spirit: consciousness, creativity, passion, joy, poetry. So it's a conversation between me and a wonderful writer, Leon Wieseltier, and also a neuroscientist, Miguel Nicolelis, trying to really how science affects our everyday life.
That's cool. Where's that one?
That one's at the Skirball Center at NYU tomorrow night. Yes, that'll be great.
Sylvia Earle, your work now, I see, is all about saving the oceans you've spent so much time in. Is spreading the word what brings you to the festival?
Saving humankind. But it starts with looking at what keeps us alive. And that is a planet that works in our favor. And that really focuses on the ocean, since the ocean, where most of the water is, is crucial to all life, including our own. And the awareness that in just the space of the lifetime of people now around, myself included, we've witnessed an extraordinary change, really. Time of loss, but also a beginning of a turnaround, which is cause for hope.
And I think the first thing that comes to a lot of people's minds when they think about the oceans and saving the planet is sea level rise as a result of global warming. But I'm sure you would put other big things into a category with that. What should I say? Overfishing, the dying coral reefs? What's near the top of your list?
It all ties together. It's maintaining a planet with all of its elements that have taken all preceding history, I mean, not human history, but all preceding Earth history, lots of ups and downs over the ages that have preceded the arrival of human beings. But we have a planet that now is just right for us. We have an atmosphere. Think Mars. You can't hop out of a spacecraft and breathe the atmosphere of Mars, but here we take it for granted. But we must not, because we're changing the atmosphere through our actions. That means changing the chemistry of Earth, changing the chemistry of the ocean. Everything is shifting.
Now, in your case, do I see correctly that you're not just going to be talking about high science on panels at the World Science Festival, but also participating in the Moth storytelling event and letting City High School students interview you?
Well, sure. Why not? That'll be fun.
How does the moth thing work? Don't you have to
Have wings?
Have to know a story, right? You have to know a story by heart. You can't read a script at the Moth, right?
Yeah, that's right. It has to come straight from the heart.
And it has to be true.
Oh, that, yes.
That's right. They have
even more fun.
Fact checkers. did you really give that money to those veterans?
That's right.
Nobody's going to ask you that. Which is scarier, being charged by sharks, as I've read you've experienced, or storytelling without notes?
Oh, I've never been charged by sharks.
Oh, I read that somewhere.
I've been inspected by sharks, but I've done much more looking at them. They have much more to fear from humans than we do from them.
Brian Greene, the festival opens, I see, with a tribute to Dr. Oliver Sacks,
yes.
who did so much to popularize neuroscience and touch so many people with his life story. Is he a guiding spirit for the festival or for you in any way?
Very much so. Long before the festival, of course, I was a great fan of Oliver Sacks. I mean, his books certainly had a profound impact on the way I've tried to bring science out to the public. I mean, he had this wonderful poetic, lyrical spirit where he could take issues that most of us wanted to turn away from and make it compelling, make us want to learn about the issues of the mind and the brain. And he was a great friend of the festival every year. He would mark off his calendar the 5 days of the festival each spring, and he participated in so many events, from issues of face blindness to issues of time in the mind to music in the brain, a program we did up at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. So a great friend of the festival. And tonight's program will really celebrate all that he gave both to science and to the world more generally.
Mathematician, physicist, and World Science Festival co-founder Brian Greene with us, and oceanographer Sylvia Earle, as we preview the World Science Festival and talk some oceanography, the World Science Festival today through Sunday. If anybody has a question or something you want to throw in here, everything you want to know about oceanography but never had Sylvia Earle over to dinner, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. There's news this morning that NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, just announced a roadmap to protecting animals in the ocean from, quote, pervasive underwater noise. Good news for whales this morning?
Well, also fish and shrimp and cephalopods, the squids and octopuses, you know.
They're sensitive to noise?
Well, yes. And they also make sounds. I mean, lobsters. Anybody who's ever thrown a lobster into a pot of boiling water knows that lobsters scream. You know, they don't like that. But they also use sound to communicate with one another. Fish do. Fish make sounds.
So what is
so much
this
we've learned.
Pervasive underwater noise that they need to be protected from?
Well, think about how the world was a century ago, before the large-scale traffic in the ocean, the motorized vessels that now thunder their way through the oceans. If you look at a map that shows the traffic, it's it's a new world. And it's not just for the creatures that are exposed to the sounds underwater. And it's more than that. It's the sonar that has served us so well in terms of finding things underwater, alien submarines that we want to find, and also fish finding. We're using sonars to find where the fish are. Fish have no place to hide anymore, given our new means of discovering where they are.
And then how do these noises affect underwater life?
Depends on it affects communication for one thing. Imagine trying to talk at a restaurant where music is blaring away. But whales communicate over hundreds of miles, and their ability to stay in touch with one another is compromised by this avalanche of new noise. And it's really amazing. And it's new on our watch, especially since the middle of the 20th century, and the pace is picking up. I attended a conference once about shipping, and the question posed was, what if we knew 50 years ago what we now know about the impact of sound? Because it's expensive to have these big propellers that cavitate, which is part of the sound-producing part. It's not efficient. A nice, quiet, efficient motor it doesn't cost as much in terms of fuel. And so we just haven't thought about the impact of sound until now. The reality of sonar used for testing, some of the Navy sonar, it's obviously important for defense, but it's also critical to understand the impact. The high-intensity sound that is used sometimes for justifiable reasons, but is killing whales with sound.
When you said whales communicate with each other over hundreds of miles, what do they need to tell each other so far apart?
Where are you? Here I am. Where are you? And just as we communicate, imagine if we did not have the ability to stay in touch.
But hundreds of miles away for safety, for mating, for turf.
Probably all those things and more. Elephants also communicate with low-frequency sound that we became aware of only fairly recently. We couldn't hear it, so we didn't know. But they can hear with their big ears and their low-frequency booms of sound. It's staying together, knowing where you are, so meeting up or avoiding one another sometimes. This is my turf, as you say. Steer clear.
Brian Green on the World Science Festival and what people could do there between now and Sunday. I see there are several events for people who want to participate, like the Great Fish Count and the stargazing that I mentioned earlier on Saturday, or the Street Science All Day Sunday. Want to go down this list a little bit? What's the Great Fish Count?
Oh, well, that's something that Sylvia Earle can tell you more about than I can at some level. So it's an event where kids and families put on waders and go into some of New York's waterways and try to see what's out there, count the number of fish of various species, and gather some data about what's actually happening in the waters around New York. So it's a small-scale version of what Sylvia has dedicated her life to, really.
I love the idea of fish watching and fish counting, just as bird watching has become a really important element in terms of getting people to realize the world around us. I wish that instead of using hooks and lines, we'd use face masks and fins, even in the Hudson River. Come on.
I agree with you completely. Now, you should know you're talking to a vegan over here, so I don't do any harm whatsoever.
I mean, I love the idea behind catch and release, but it's really torture and release.
Of course.
Would you like to be hooked and looked at and counted and then thrown back in the ocean or
not
the
often.
River? I mean, there are other ways. And catching in a net, too, to count them. We don't do that so much with birds and other things.
Yep.
We need to have respect. I say, do unto fish as you would have them do unto you.
Gregory in Manhattan, very biblical. Gregory in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi there. Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. Ms. Cecilia, this whole thing about giant squid has been part of, you know, I guess our lives in many books and novels that we read. And I just read recently that they are becoming more prolific in the oceans. Is that correct, or have I read it wrong?
I don't think anyone can answer that with a straight answer, because we simply don't know. The first giant squid was seen in its own realm just in very recent years, last 4 or 5 years. And, of course, there are records. And, you know, Oliver Sacks was a great fan of squids and octopuses and other cephalopods, maybe because they're such brainy creatures and kindred spirits.
Yeah.
But they, whatever, giant squids, like their other relatives, it's hard to imagine that their relatives include clams and oysters and sea slugs and snails and things. But, you know, it's respecting how they all tie together. Are there more giant squids today than there have been in the past? Probably not likely. But more being seen, more being recorded, well, that is for sure, because we're gaining increased access to their deep, dark realms.
Gregory, thank you very much for your call, 212-433-WNYC, and Sage in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you? I'm so excited to be on. I just wanted to say that I went to art school, and I fell in love with physics maybe about 6 or 7 years ago, and Brian Greene and Neil deGrasse Tyson really changed my life, and the World Science Festival is like the one event that I look forward to all year long, and I'm super excited. I have tickets for every night, so I want to thank Brian Green for making such an amazing event, and thank Dr. Sylvia Earle for all the work she does on behalf of animals
as a
vegan and animal rights activist.
What was one World Science Festival event you went to in the past that sticks out in your mind?
I went to one on dark matter, and Dr. Brian Green's performance which I actually don't remember the name now because I'm so nervous.
Yeah, but it's Light Falls. In fact, we're going to do a version of that tomorrow, Friday. Yeah.
I have tickets. Like, I saw it last year. I try to see it every year that it performs, and it's like, mind-blowing to me.
Well, thank you. It's so nice of you to say. That's a performance which studies the discovery of Einstein's general relativity in a theatrical format. So with three actors, and I play basically the role of a narrator, Jeff Beal, who does the music for House of Cards, wrote an original score, which is quite beautiful, and 59 Productions. You may know them. They got the Tony Award for An American in Paris. They work with us to create visuals of curved space and the motion of Mercury around the sun. So it's kind of a real immersive experience, allowing you to see physics in a somewhat different way.
Ross in New Windsor, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ross.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Good morning, Professor Earle. My daughter, a budding environmental engineering grad from RPI last week, is traveling to the Palmyra Atoll this summer to undertake wetlands restoration. Now, while we're hoping to come to your Friday night panel, in case we can't, are there any quick tips that you may have for my daughter as she prepares for her environmental work?
I didn't think we were going to do career advice on the show today, but what the heck, Dr. Earle?
Well, don't listen to those who say you can't do something. Just if you have your eye on something that you feel strongly about, find a way to make it happen, over, under, around, through, whatever it takes. There are hundreds of people who tell you, no, you can't do that. Don't listen to them.
What would you tell Ross's daughter about using the word science as a verb, like Matt Damon's character did in The Martian? Does that connect with your work?
It does connect with it. We want science to be an active word. We want science to be a word that fires you up, not a word that you view as just a label for a class that you took back in school. That's not science. That's dead science. Living science, breathing science is the discovery. It's what Sylvia does out in the world. It's what we physicists do at the Large Hadron Collider.
It's what kids do.
It's what kids do
all
naturally.
The time. Yeah.
That's how they start out. And people always say to me, how do you get kids interested in science? I'm like, what? You don't have to get them interested in science. You have to stop stamping out their interest by having them take classes which don't get them excited and doesn't keep that interest going. So, you know, back to what you were saying before, Saturday night, bring your kids out to Brooklyn Bridge Park. We got stargazing. We'll have telescopes out there. Take them out to Washington Square Park on Sunday. All sorts of wonderful activities for kids and families to just get excited about these wondrous ideas.
Brian Green, co-founder of the World Science Festival, oceanographer Sylvia Earle, one of the participants in the events between now and Sunday, and Ron in Farmingdale. You're on WNYC. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Brian. I was listening before, and your guest said that when you drop a lobster into the pot, it starts to scream. And I've always been told that that is just the sound of the water steaming out of the tightly knit pieces of the armor of the actual animal itself. Is there any truth to that?
No. Well, there probably are some physical sounds that result from the escaping of air from places within the shell of the lobster, but lobsters communicate. I have been touched by spiny lobsters, curious, and they make a purring sound. And when they're startled, they make that sound that you also can elicit if you drop them in a pot of boiling water.
Oh, that kind of makes me sad.
Well, it makes you just, again, do unto lobsters as you would have lobsters do unto you.
Right. Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And I see that you've compared the deep sea diving that you've done to the work of astronauts. Is it because there are the same problems for land animals who need oxygen in these different environments?
Well, this is part of the universe, too, part of the solar system, Earth, mostly blue, at least where the life is. It's in the ocean, by and large. And we're just beginning to explore it. And some of the methods used for going high in the sky and packaging people in inhospitable places, you have to package people to go into the ocean because you can't breathe the water around you, like breathe in the water. But so having suits that actually deliver one atmosphere, same pressure as astronaut suits, I've had a chance to use some of these systems, or little submarines that can go to full ocean depth, as James Cameron was able to do. And two people before him back in 1960, only three people have been to the deepest part of our own blue ocean, 7 miles, 11 kilometers down. Meanwhile, more people have walked on the moon, and many more have gone as astronauts high in the sky. We're neglecting the ocean. Exploring the skies above has paid off handsomely, and we need to do more of it, but we should not be neglecting our own planet from the inside out.
Before you go, Dr. Earle, we started the show today with a conversation about that tragedy at the Cincinnati Zoo over the weekend, where that four-year-old boy got into a gorilla enclosure and they wound up killing the gorilla. And we got into the larger question with a guest who's a zookeeper about keeping animals in captivity for the entertainment of humans or even for, I know, what zookeepers consider a conservation purpose. I wonder how you feel about this, given your work. Sometimes this has to do with sea creatures kept in captivity. Do you see value to that kind of thing?
Well, we're in a transition, I would say, from a time when animals were treated as things for entertainment mainly.
Certainly SeaWorld is changing its standards with respect to, is it the dolphins?
The orcas, the big dolphins, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, and dolphins, other marine mammals, and even large fish, such as the whale sharks that and tunas, whatever. There is value, at least for now. People who would never see a shark alive under congenial circumstances, or a grouper, or a cod for that matter, or anything, a shrimp, a lobster. We have the best of all possible worlds. We would take ourselves into their world. And I realize I have had the privilege of doing that in ways that I wish everyone could share that view because they would change their perspective.
So captivity could be humane for the sake of education.
Well, it's a trade-off. You know, the animals involved are basically ambassadors, and they didn't ask. We couldn't communicate. Say, do you mind if we put you in captivity for the next rest of your life? The least we can do is treat them with respect and dignity. And the idea that much we have learned about how to repair injured animals has come from those who work with aquariums and zoos. You know, there is value, and we need to just think about the world from their standpoint.
Brian Green, how can people get tickets to the World Science Festival events?
Best way is go to the website, worldsciencefestival.com. There's a complete listing of both the free programs we discussed as well as the ticketed ones. So go now. Tickets are selling out. So if you want to go, I'd go there soon.
Yeah, just one more thing.
Sure.
You know, I love the World Science Festival, and it's not just about the kids. It's finding the kid in everyone and awakening that sense of curiosity and wonder. But it's also learning that science is not about a white coat and all those instruments and things. It's about a way of thinking. It's about observing carefully and reporting honestly what you see, being able to evaluate the reality, evidence from the hokum, the stuff that, you know, it's everyone should have science as at their central core, along with language and numbers.
That's right. Science is really a perspective. It's a way of evaluating what we see in the world and figuring out what's right and what's not. And that's what the Science Festival is all about.
Hear, hear.
Evidence-based living. Thank you, Brian Green, co-founder of the World Science Festival and professor of math and physics at Columbia University and marine biologist and oceanographer, Sylvia Earle. Find out more about events and ticketing happening today through Sunday at worldsciencefestival.com, and we'll put a link on our webpage at wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Dr. Green, Dr. Earle, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay tuned.